welcome to our Biz Huddle podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Cuthbert, Creative Director at Baker Creative. If you haven't already subscribed to the channel, please hit subscribe so you can get notified when new content comes out. Please share this with anyone who could be inspired by it.
Most Reverend Earl Fernandez was ordained and installed as the 13th Bishop of the Diocese of Columbus, serving 23 counties and more than 278,000 members. Born in Toledo, Ohio, he was the first Indian American bishop to serve the diocese. He was previously a pastor of St. Ignatius of Loyola Church in Cincinnati and a staff member of the Apostolic Nunciature in Washington, D.C., and dean of the Athenaeum of Ohio, Mount St. Mary's Seminary of the West in Cincinnati. Bishop Fernandez received a doctorate in moral theology from the Alphonsian Academy in Rome. Welcome, Bishop Fernandez.
Welcome to our podcast. I'm so excited to have you.
Oh, it's great to be back.
You had such great insight and thought there were so many more topics we could talk about. And I thought, why not explore the workplace environment and culture?
Sure. And so many people today are working in what we might call toxic environments. A lot of people love their jobs, but a lot of people, if they have work, get beaten down by their work, and they want nothing more than to go home or to escape from the workplace. Sometimes they've received their education and training and they go to work and their ideas aren't received and they get frustrated. Other times there's always kind of office politics and they hate going into work. Or sometimes many, many demands are placed upon them in the workplace that just makes life extra stressful. When I lived in Washington, D.C., working at the Vatican Embassy, I would see a lot of young people out and about at restaurants and bars and things, but they were always actually working, even when at moments of relaxation, because they were under pressure to perform and their bosses were just pushing them and pushing them. And then they lose the love for the work. When we work, we want to contribute something of ourselves to the work. And many people find themselves in what we call dead-end jobs or toxic workplaces. And so the question is, how can you cope with that? Or if you're a person of faith, when you go to work, but most of the people with whom you work are not believers, and they make the workplace environment very difficult, at least on the surface. You know, they say that of those who are baptized Catholic, 50% profess no religion by age 30. And half of those profess no religious affiliation whatsoever by age 13. So many people who are persons of faith, might be Catholic, go into the workplace and you have lapsed Catholics or people who are against organized religion. So if faith is very important to you, how do you then function in such an environment? This past Sunday, the gospel reading is from Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. Verses 1 through 12 are the Beatitudes. And Jesus there says, you know, blessed are you when they persecute you and ever utter every insult against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, your reward will be great in heaven. And so we have that promise, which brings us some consolation. But when you're, you know, stuck in the thick of things, when everything seems dark, when you're going into work day after day, what do you do, or how are you supposed to respond? Well, again, Jesus in those verses 13 through 16 in Matthew chapter 5 says, you are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world. Second Vatican Council called the lay faithful to be a leaven in the world. To be salt means to help purify the culture with the gospel values. To be salt means to add flavor to the world in a world that has grown bitter or stale. And we do that really by practicing the virtues. Someone once told me, if you just be patient, be generous and kind, people will love you. And there's a truth to that. But patience, one saint says, is that which one is willing to suffer out of love for another. So always at the root of practicing the virtues is the greatest of virtues, which is charity. But to be light of the world, I mean, the light of faith helps us to see things that we wouldn't otherwise see. You know, we can know certain things by science, by historical knowledge and so on. But faith also opens up a new vision of the workplace, a new vision of the work itself, when we contribute something of ourselves to the work for the greater glory of God. Or when we're in a toxic work environment, we're doing the same thing day in, day out, and we might not enjoy it anymore. We can say, God, because of my love for you, I'll do this task or that task. And so it's not just the work that we do, but the love with which we do it. To be a light in the world also means to reach out to those who are dwelling in darkness, who don't yet have the gift of faith. But sometimes this, the darkness is in a different way, because in our humanity, we all have the experience, for example, of suffering or of loneliness or of just practical frustration with the work, not knowing the technical know-how. But what a difference it makes when someone mentors us, or when someone looks at us with a gaze of love, or when someone can even empathize with us. Many times the role of the Christian is to be a person who is present. And there's a ministry of presence even prior to an explicit discussion of faith. I'm here for you. I'm with you. I'm in this with you. And I think that goes a long way. You look a little down, a simple open-ended question. You look a little down today. Is everything okay? That actually shows a concern, a deep concern for the person who is in front of me. So I'm attentive, not just to are they technically doing their work, but how is this person really? Asking the question and asking it, how are you doing today, and really meaning it, can go a long way. And that can open up a conversation. Well, I'm down because, you know, my mother got news that she had cancer. I'm sorry to hear about that. I'll pray for that. You know, even it's a bold step sometimes for Catholics say, would you like to pray? But sometimes people do, and they just need the simple personal invitation. Or we see somebody's down and we invite them, would you like to go out for a cup of coffee after work? And have these little pauses or moments where not everything is about work. Joseph Pieper was a German philosopher in the 20th century, and he wrote this book, Leisure as the Basis of Culture, because he made this argument that we all need rest, and yet we become slaves, what he calls slaves of the work state. Work drives our life. And in the end, efficiency and being efficient at the work drives our life, rather than simply doing something for the enjoyment of doing something, not for its value in terms of productivity. And so I think being in the workplace, being patient and generous and kind, reaching out to others, even in a toxic environment. Jesus goes on in the subsequent passages in the Sermon on the Mount to say, you have heard it said to you, you shall not kill. But I say to you, you shall not grow angry with your brother. You know, he speaks about turning the other cheek, going the extra mile, loving our enemies. These are not just kind of phrases or throwing out an ideal or an impossible. Rather, these are his basic expectations, but do we actually do them? And I think that's a great challenge. Like, what does it really mean to be a disciple when there is hardship? St. Paul says it is necessary for us to endure much suffering in order to enter the kingdom. And yet we're so used to, at least in this country, meeting our goals. Some years ago, when I was writing my doctoral dissertation, I read a book by an Italian sociologist. And I guess in English, we translate it as children of divorced parents. Okay. And it basically was talking about why so many people have difficulty even entering into relationships. And this Italian sociologist, she basically contended, like, in the 20th century, while we had great wars and things like that, we also had incredible progress, especially after the war. Mm-hmm. Scientific progress, the development of antibiotics and medicines and things like that, technological progress, economic progress, great productivity after the war. So we're used to having success. But what happens when we don't always have success? And this was true, especially in relationships. Prior to the legalization of divorce in most of Western Europe and the United States, people stuck through marriages in difficult situations. Sometimes for the sake of children, sometimes just because it's what you did, you know, this. And so when things became difficult, people from a previous generation lived with the difficulty. They learned how to suffer. They learned how to work through their sufferings and their challenges. And they were willing to persevere at it for a long time. But a modern mentality is now things are disposable. Or I can get out of the situation by signing this paper or that paper. And So the idea of persevering through difficulty, she said, is not as present. And this she attributed then to the breakdown of so many marriages and the rapid increase of divorce in Italy and so on. So that sometimes there's the idea of what does it mean to really persevere at a task, even in a difficult situation?
So I had a question. So with the workplace being so stressful, how do, you know, parents not bring it home because the kids take a hit for it, right? I mean, that's being
not just the kids, but even the spouses. So my father was a physician for many, many years, and he had a great ability. You know, he had his patients, they had their illnesses, their concerns, but he had a great ability to, you know, he might bring it to prayer or something like that. But when he came home, he didn't burden my mom or us with what his patients were going through. And there's a degree of confidentiality also involved in that privacy. But my mother, when she retired, she had been a counselor. So naturally she was a helper and very concerned. She decided she'd work in my dad's office. She'd come home and say, "Oh, Sydney, I'm worried about Mrs. So-and-so. She's 92. Her children never call her. And she's worried about going to the nursing home." It was driving my dad crazy. Right? Because we have genuine concern for others. How do we not bring it home? Some strategies. I had a good friend of mine in Cincinnati. He was a lawyer. His wife stayed at home and they homeschooled. They had six children. And so it was very stressful. His wife was very talented. She was gifted with art and with music. And she herself had been a teacher. So she knew how to manage kids, but it's still stressful. You got kids all kinds of ages running around, making noise, not always being obedient, fighting with each other, but getting along. And their kids were actually pretty well behaved. But my friend Pete, he would he'd come home from work. And of course, the kids would be eager to see him. And his wife would need a break. But he needed a break from work. And he found that what would happen was he'd walk in the door, the kids would be all over him, he'd get agitated, and then he'd be agitated with his wife. And I said, "Look, first of all, when you drive home, shut the radio off, don't listen to talk radio, don't listen to those things which would otherwise agitate you. Mm-hmm. When you come to your driveway, and on the way home, maybe you pray, maybe you just have silence, you allow yourself to gradually calm down. But when you get to your driveway, before you go into the house, just sit in your car for 60 seconds. Just sit there, get your thoughts together, say a little prayer, have a little silence, let yourself be calm, and then start to think about when you walk in the door, how would you like the conversation to go? Prepare yourself for what you're going to receive when you get in the door. So what are your initial moves going to be? What are your phrases going to be? What has triggered you in the past? And prepare yourself for a better strategy, a better outcome. Mm-hmm. With your wife, what's the first thing you want to tell her? And, you know, there might be lots of stuff that you want to tell her, but maybe one of the first things you need to do is ask, how was your day? And to listen, because she's been burdened with the day with all these things. And you can see, and you have to be attentive to body language. So prepare yourself mentally and spiritually for what you're going to walk into. Because the people you're going to go meet when you walk in that door aren't your enemies, right? They're the people you love most in the world and care about most in the world. So what is God's expectation for you as to how you're going to care for them and speak to them and receive them and greet them? And I think many people don't do that. They think, man, I'm running. I've listened to this talk radio and the news, and it's got me down, and it's got me angry, and blah, 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 blah. And now I've got more to do when I get home because I got to help with the kids, and I got to help with the chores, and I got to do these other things, and I still have this other work left to do. And so I think one of the things that this allows us to do is to have perspective. What is really, truly important in life? My first pastor, he had been secretary to Archbishop Bernardine in Cincinnati. And he had also been the pre-secretary to Archbishop Leibold. Archbishop Leibold died very suddenly of an aneurysm in 1972. And when he died, there were three trays on his desk of papers: extremely urgent, urgent, and not urgent. But it took a long time for Archbishop Leibold to be replaced. And my first pastor then saw that those papers just sat there and sat there and sat there. And so one day he just decided he was going to throw them all out. They weren't that urgent after all. And I think that's one of the things that we also have to see. Look, not everything has to be done tonight. I was one, you know, I'm a workaholic by nature. But in the end, I found that, like, look, it takes a great deal of discipline to just shut down the computer and to be. But that's one of the skills that I learned how to do. Like, I'm not going to let work drive me. I think that's also one of the downsides to the cell phones and things is it has made us perpetually available so that we no longer have time for some of our hobbies to find the balance that we need in life. So I think there are other things that can help us in relationships and help us balance, find, you know, the right work-life balance. And then those include eating properly, exercising, and sleeping. Some basic things. If we don't do those well, if we don't, you know, people speak about being hangry, you know, when they don't eat and they get angry and agitated. It's true.
Do you feel like with people working partially at home, like the remote teams and stuff, and I find it interesting that they're saying loneliness is at an all-time high, especially since, you know, COVID, but COVID's been over for a while. What is your take on all that?
Well, I think COVID's been over for a while, but the psychological and emotional and spiritual damage has been done. Right. People don't know how to be. Their whole plan of life and project in life was based and their own sense of self-worth was based on what they did, not who they are. In my field, my doctoral degree is in moral theology. And so we speak of human dignity. And there are two concepts of dignity, attributed dignity and inherent dignity. Attributed dignity tends to value the person for what they do, how much money they make, what they look like, how handsome or beautiful they are, what their athletic ability is. And when people lose their ability or those attributes that gave them a sense of self-worth, they say, I feel like I have lost my dignity. Mm-hmm. We see this especially in people who are elderly or sick, and this it becomes one of the reasons why they demand physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the concept of inherent dignity is you have value independently of what you do. And the virtue of being a human person made in God's image and likeness, you have a degree of worth, not because of your abilities, but simply because you are irrepeatable. There will never be another you, and I value you for you. Mm-hmm. So, but when we're live in a world that is driven by efficiency, when our educational models educate for efficiency, when you're valued based on your productivity, when your salary is commensurate to your productivity, and then all of a sudden you lose your job because of a pandemic. Mm-hmm. What is there left? When you have this plan of your trajectory for your career, and then all of a sudden it goes away, or your company gets bought out by another company and you're downsized and you're made redundant, you're replaced by a machine. It can be demoralizing for people. And I think that happened in COVID. I think also then starting things back up takes a great deal of mental and spiritual and emotional energy to cope with the loneliness. And though we're interconnected through technology, it's different from a personal encounter with another person. Mm-hmm. Like how many people during the pandemic, I spent a lot of time in the hospital anointing the sick and treating dying COVID patients, but family members could not be with their loved ones. They couldn't hold their hands, couldn't touch them. And there was a great deal of anxiety. And again, how do people deal with anxiety or stress? You know, I'm a person of faith, so I can turn to the Lord. But if you don't have that, or when you lose a loved one and the severe psychological damage and emotional damage, or a kind of, you know, Jimmy Carter many years ago talked about a great malaise setting in over the country. And I think this is also one of the things that happened. When you don't have anything to do, when you've been told you're valued by what to do, and then you have to be, and you don't know what to do, and you don't know how to be, all of a sudden, this kind of a type of a lethargy or laziness begins to set in. And then it just becomes all you feel like doing is sitting on the couch and watching TV, and you lose your zest and your zeal for life. And it's hard to really recover, because to recover it, you have to build up good habits. And these habits eventually are formed into virtues. And so we have to rebuild the work ethic and the discipline that's necessary to keep going on, the discipline that's necessary to be physically fit and to be attentive And again, we also, so I think, you know, people are, the economy is little by little is getting back, going a little again. And employment numbers were reasonably good, better maybe even than expected. But it still doesn't mean that people have gained their confidence back.
I agree.
Because it is a great blow to confidence.
It is. So they're projecting in the future that there's going to be a lot of shortages in just workers in general across pretty much everything.
Yeah.
So how does, and that includes the priests, right? So how can parishioners, how can, you know, best support the church? Because, you know, that's happening everywhere. It's not really just the church, you know?
It's true. I mean, it's engaging members, whether it's your business or a church. So recently I was in St. Louis. The Fellowship of Catholic University Students has its annual conference called SEEK. There were 17,000 young people, and I had to preach. And I talked about being a spiritual entrepreneur, right? And so a spiritual entrepreneur is one who has a vision. You have to decide, am I going to be a leader or a manager? What is my vision? And to clearly articulate that. The spiritual entrepreneur, he knows what he or she is good at, has a great sense of self-awareness, strengths, but stays focused on task, and then surrounds himself or herself with the people who have complementary skills. So I don't have to worry about these things that I'm not very good at that are going to be very time consuming. I can have good people around me who can do those things. And that's why I think the lay faithful can really help the priests. A spiritual entrepreneur, I said, is also someone who's a salesman. I said, what would it be like if every priest had to go out and fundraise his own salary, and it would be based upon number of baptisms, confessions, weddings, communions, Sunday mass attendance? Priests would be going out knocking door to door. But the same way, we have to have an enthusiasm for the mission. We have to be so convicted of the mission that we're engaged then. But people are actually drawn to and want to work for persons of integrity. They don't want to work for someone who they know is dishonest or is going to discard them as soon as you're no longer useful or productive, right? They want someone who's going to be loyal and faithful, who's reliable in carrying out his or her duties. And you're drawn naturally to the hard worker, to the person who's honest, person of integrity. That's who you want to work for. And then finally, in addition to being, you know, being drawn to a person of integrity, they would say a spiritual entrepreneur is a servant leader. And servant leadership kind of is a catchphrase. But I asked a man, well, that sounds kind of corny, kind of 70s-ish. He said, well, it basically means, are you ready to sacrifice yourself first, or are you ready to sacrifice others? I think for priests, they have to be spiritual entrepreneurs. They have to attract people. They have to be persons of integrity themselves. But they also have to realize, hey, the lay faithful have these gifts. For example, I know how to read a spreadsheet and I can do some things financially, but I rely on financial experts to give me the bigger picture, to help me to interpret the data that I'm seeing with respect to finances, to say, this is what we need to invest in, this not. Here's where we've cut all our expenses. Now we need to come up with a new revenue stream. I need that expertise. I have a doctorate in moral theology, bioethics. I'm blessed because three of my brothers are physicians. So during the pandemic, I was regularly consulting, not just with my brothers, but with other medical experts to better understand how to minister in this environment. We have a lot of people who work for the Diocese of Columbus who have expertise, not a lot, but who have great expertise, for example, in property management. And so they help us to maintain our buildings, but they help us to acquire new properties where we think that the population is going to grow. Lay people have a lot of skills, even with marriage preparation. There are not a lot of priests who meet with couples anymore. It's going to be more and more lay couples preparing young men and women for marriage and accompanying them not just to the wedding ceremony, but even after, to help them to be integrated into a parish. I think about our Catholic schools. We just finished Catholic Schools Week. And we've got a lot of lay teachers who are assisting in the mission. And so more and more lay people are using their gifts and talents. And that's going to happen. It happens at a diocesan level, but it also is happening more and more at parishes, because sometimes you don't have a resident priest any longer. Now, I just was at a parish where they had the last Sunday mass. And there was one priest for four parishes, and the parishes are country parishes and they're all over the place. And he's driving a lot, and it just is an impossible situation to maintain. But he might make some use of lay missionaries in the area, and the lay people are still going to carry out their works amongst the poor and still try to catechize and educate the children. but it's a joint effort. So we speak of co-responsibility for the future of the church. A lot of times people keep doing things and the same people doing things over and over. And I think part of the priest's leadership ability has to be identifying the gifts and talents of other parishioners and inviting them to be part of the mission. There's nothing more frustrating when you have a certain degree of enthusiasm and you can never break in because someone won't ever relinquish a role that they've been doing for a long time. Even simple things, sometimes the younger generations have a lot to offer, even in terms of technology. Like at one of my old parishes, like the secretaries and facilities managers were reluctant even to use email. And then the pandemic happened. We were live streaming everything and we were talking about online giving. And they said, nobody will ever do that, online giving. But let's put a QR code so people can give directly from the bulletin. They never thought of these sorts of things. But it was the young people who were like, you know, Father, you got to make things convenient for young people and young families and this and this and this. And these are some options for you. And so they bring things to the fore that can help us as a church, which generally moves slowly, to streamline operations, to be efficient, to be good stewards of other people's resources.
Absolutely. And I think those are wonderful things to have it being all inclusive. But that's the reason why I kind of wanted to talk about, you know, what happens in some of the cultures. Some cultures are quite toxic. And I myself have worked in those environments and it can be very draining. And you just want to find a way to insulate yourself and still be able to have a good work balance, like you had discussed.
You know, I think you want to have a good work balance, but I don't know that insulating oneself is always the best thing to do. That is, for example, our problems don't go away, right? Even if we insulated ourselves, even if we built a wall around ourselves, they'd still be there. The enemy would still be outside the gate. Rather, from a Christian perspective, we go forward with a disarming beauty, the beauty of our faith. Our problems don't go away, but we confront them differently because of our relationship with Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. So this person is attacking me. How do I turn the other cheek? How do I respond with a kind word? Or why must I always presume that they have it out for me? The worst motivation. Couldn't I give them the benefit of the doubt? Am I really being objective now in my judgment? Or do I myself need to have a conversion of mind, a conversion of heart, in order to better be able to see this? Or sometimes when I used to hear confessions, I used to ask myself, well, why is this person really here? Or what are they really trying to say? And it's an art to kind of read between the lines, to read body language, to understand the perspective. But then I also think, well, why are they this way? Why are they always attacking? Why do they seem so insecure? I wonder if something's going on with their spouse or with their children at home. Or maybe they're under financial stress or have physical problems that I don't know about. Have I really tried to encounter the other person to get to know them and to understand where they are coming from? I think that's an important thing to do, and we don't do it because we've been pushed to be productive, to get ahead, to get what's coming to us, to succeed, to get the promotion, to get the higher salary, as if any of that would make us truly happy or would satisfy the desires of our hearts. In truth, we have deep human longings for truth, goodness, beauty, and love, to find a place to belong, which money can't satisfy. I knew a guy in my first parish. He had 7 children, and he worked hard to provide for his family. Again, and he had his man cave down in his basement. This would have been around the time that George W. Bush was president, and he would go down to his man cave. And he would have his American flag and his picture of the president and his guns on the wall and a huge big screen TV. And he'd sit there with a 64-ouncer in his chair and he'd say, "Fine, you know, Father, I love TV. I can just watch TV all day after a hard day of work. I like to sit in my chair and have a drink and watch TV in my man cave." But then he said, "You know what? TV doesn't love me back. My kids, they love me back." And so he learned how to shut off the TV a little bit more and spend more time with his kids who were dying for his attention. How many people are longing for personal attention, to be valued, not for what they do, but for who they are? to be shown rather than a gaze of judgment, a gaze of mercy, or at least compassion or empathy. I was reading a book, and it was about the overuse of technology. It was called Reclaiming the Conversation. It was written by a woman from MIT, and she also wrote another book called Alone Together. But it was basically like family members don't actually have conversations anymore. They text each other because they're afraid of losing control of their emotions. They want to edit their conversations. They can't deal with each other in real time. The same is true with young people when they go to parties. They have FOMO, fear of missing out. And so they're always on their phones to find the next best party, yet they're never actually experiencing life. I think this happens also in the workplace. We don't experience friendships the way we used to with coworkers. We don't experience life together with them. You know, this experience of togetherness is also what we call the virtue of solidarity. Rather than seek our own individual success and glory, we have to be in solidarity with our coworkers and recognize we have a common mission, a common goal. And so sometimes it's necessary to hit the reset button, to go back and say, have I really been fair to this person who I don't get along with, who's attacking? Or if I had to say only good things about this person, what would they be? Could I at least have that perspective? Or if they're mean and nasty to me, is it necessary for me always to be a doormat? Or could I push back gently?
Do you think that's what the silent quit is? And, you know, some of the, because some management can be quite rough, right?
Yeah. I mean, some management can't. So, but I think people are tired of being trampled upon, yet they don't know how to stand up for themselves because they fear the ultimate repercussion of losing one's job because of how they value themselves. But which is worse, to be trampled upon day in, day out, or to be free of that and have an opportunity to search for something else, even as difficult as that might mean, or short term might bring a great deal of anxiety or insecurity. I think the other part is, must I always retaliate? If they are nasty, do I always have to push back with nastiness and seek revenge? Mm-hmm. Or can I, you know, hold my tongue? Can I kind of smother them with kindness, if you will? Or what is my role in a bleak work environment to be salt, to be light, to bring joy, to bring hope? Little thoughtful things, a little note to someone. You did this nicely, I appreciate it, or thanks for caring about such and such. You know, I think these things can help build up some morale, little acts of gratitude or expressions of gratitude. I think that's another thing. Part of the reason our workplaces are somewhat toxic is we don't say thank you. We don't show our appreciation often enough in little things and in great things. Mm-hmm. I remember like our Paris secretaries, they weren't always very well paid, and I wanted to kind of just do a little something for them. And I gave them a little bit of a raise, but I thought, you know, there's some other things we could do. Like in the break room, let's get a new coffee pot. Let's get a new refrigerator. This stuff is, you know, 40 years old. And how about a microwave so that they can heat up their lunch? That's okay. And from time to time, I would try and buy them lunch just to say thank you in a small way, because what they did was infinitely more valuable than a new coffee pot or microwave or refrigerator. So it's kind of, you know, we always want to encourage our children to be thoughtful, but are we thoughtful in the same way in the workplace? Is work a place where, is the environment a place where I actually want to go?
And that can be for management as well, not just everyone.
Yeah. And we shouldn't presume, because we're a worker and life's hard for us, that the upper management doesn't also have stressors in their life. I mean, you look at surveys of doctors and lawyers and engineers, and they all have high rates of depression and suicide and, you know, alcoholism, drug use too. Why? They seemingly on the surface have money and status in society. What are the stressors in their life? I knew a Catholic businessman, and the economy was bad. And he was looking at the numbers. There was just no way he could keep everyone employed. But he was weighed down by the fact that he was going to have to let people go, and that some of these people was going to have let go were had spouses and children. This weighed on him, like, what is my responsibility? We should not always presume that entrepreneurs and leaders in the business world don't also feel the stress or feel the pain. Maybe they feel it in a different way. I mean, I talked about servant leadership, and I have a good priest friend of mine. His father ran a machine tool part company. And during the Carter Ford years, the economy was bad and he was struggling to make payroll. So he went and he dipped into his family savings, his personal savings, in order to pay his workers' salaries. Mm-hmm. It would be unheard of these days for someone to do it, but he did it. And that's leadership. So what are our expectations of leadership? But I also think this is also another thing that makes working difficult these days, is that there are high expectations. You're put in a position and then you're told, okay, perform, but you're not given the leadership or training necessary to actually perform. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The second thing is we should not presume that the educational standards that once were in place are still in place. So, for example, I was once at the high school where I taught, and we were filming a video. And they said, oh, Father, pretend like you're preaching a sermon. And so I said, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the age of belief. It was the age of discourse. We had everything to gain. We had nothing to gain. And the students all said, oh, Father, that was awesome. Did you just make that up? Not having any reference whatsoever to Charles Dickens or A Tale of Two Cities or anything. So many of the educational things that we had in English and math and our knowledge of history, our ability to memorize things, that's not the educational method any longer. And yet we have high expectations. I, for one, my mother was an English teacher. I speak multiple languages and I write letters beautifully, right? But young people are used to texting or sending emails. And it makes it very difficult sometimes to communicate or to see that they've actually written something that's intelligible. Even when I was teaching at the seminary, I would sometimes write, we had a smart board, but I would sometimes also write on the blackboard, right? And I write in cursive, but my students couldn't read cursive, nor could they write in cursive. When I would give exams, the same thing. They couldn't write in cursive, so they had to print everything. But that meant that they couldn't put down as much on the paper as quickly. And so the quality of education had suffered. Now I'm thinking, okay, well, this person has a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, they should be able to perform, but they seemingly can't do what in my day was basic. It's not just that I was intelligent or gifted, the standards and the method are different. And so sometimes there's a frustration. The boss is always on me because the boss has high standard, but the boss also has to realize where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. And I can't just say, okay, boss, you know, but the standard's different, therefore you come down to my level. He's the boss. And I think that's also one of the things, is not every opinion is equal. So True. We all have something to offer, but we shouldn't presume, even if our idea is the best, we have to accept the fact that we're going to lose some battles and we're not going to win every argument. And can I accept that in humility? Can I? And that's not so easily done today.
I agree. When I taught at Capital University, we had a lot of seniors in the class, and we would say, hey, you know, did you guys do internships? What kind of experience have you had before you leave? Because it's pretty invaluable if you want to get hired. But, you know, some of them, their approach was kind of surprising sometimes, because, you know, well, if a boss doesn't do this, or like they already had these expectations, but maybe the boss didn't even know that it existed, you know? And if they don't do this, I'm gone. And it's like, well, wait a minute, we'll take a step back now. I said, you have to be open to all kinds of different people, and some you will like and some you won't, but it's still a workplace. It's still a team. You can't just, you know, because one little thing, but that comes with maturity and that comes with experience.
Right. And which requires a degree of patience, which today we jump from one thing to another. The other thing that's, I think, changing the workplace environment is our workplaces are becoming more and more diverse, culturally and linguistically diverse. And so it's important also to understand, you know, I deal with this in the Catholic Church. You know, I'm Indian, but we have a lot of, for example, African priests, we have Anglo priests, we have, Spanish speaking priests. And it's important to understand culture and family structure, how people communicate differently. In these cultures, the need for personal space versus privacy. Some cultures are very warm, others are very, you know, officious, we might say, or less warm. Mm-hmm. To begin to understand the makeup. And I think also understanding people's family background. Mm-hmm. And my parents remained married. They both had good educations, and I didn't have to deal with some of the issues that parents whose marriages broke up, the kids, some of the issues they did, and the psychological and emotional issues, and how much time sometimes that can be, one can spend dealing with some of these personal issues that could otherwise be spent on work. So the amount of personal work that, you know, interior work that people have to do, which isn't easy work, is greater for some and lesser for others. And so to be a little bit patient and more understanding of where a person's coming from, what his or her background. But the only way we can do that is by actually personally and humanly encountering another. And I don't see that happening as frequently as it used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for all your insight. It's been a wonderful experience, and I think it'll help a lot of people. It's just a lot of people, I think, are running into this, and it could give them some additional tools.
You know, a good priest friend of mine, he said, when it comes to life and ministry, you have to remember the five P's: pace, patience, perseverance, perspective, and prayer. Pace, patience, perseverance, perspective, and prayer. I think if you pace yourself in life, if you're patient with yourself and with others, if you can persevere at a task, if you can have perspective and see what's truly important, what's high priority, what's low priority, and then in the end, bring it all to prayer, giving thanks for the opportunities you've had, asking for consolation in times of sorrow or frustration, asking for the grace to keep carrying on and doing all these things with a great deal of love. I think that can really help us to go back to work and to be the leaven in the world, to be the salt of the earth, to be the light of the world.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you haven't already subscribed to the channel, please hit subscribe so you can get notified when new content comes out. Please share this with anyone who could be inspired by it, and feel free to post any questions so we can be inspired by new content. Thanks for listening. If you're interested in learning more, visit our website at bakercreative.co.